Hello, hello, and hello, everybody. Welcome back for another episode, If Not Now, When. In today's show, I am super excited to welcome my friend Jennifer Sethra. As a successful and serious entrepreneur, she loves business. From building business from ground up to scaling the operation across the globe to managing and operate two public companies globally, she loved it all. Jennifer is a master in creating partnership. She collaborated with big names such as Apple, Gates Foundation, Goodwill, just to name a few. Today, Jennifer is the founder and CEO of Intre and Antibias Tech, a revolutionary HR tech startup. Because she's done it all and done it so many times, today she has been featured on CNBC, NBC, Yahoo Finance, Austin Statement, Austin 50 Tech Company to Watch, Silicon Valley Review, wow, so many, Award 40 Under 40, and is part of a Forbes Woman. With that, my friend, I am so beyond excited. Please join me to welcome my friend Jennifer to the show. Well, thank you so much, Jennifer, for coming all the way here to join us on the show. So tell us, how does all the magic begin for you?
All the magic. Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of smoke and mirrors, right, with the magic. But if you're wondering, like, what was my evolution?
Yeah.
How did I get started? I am what I call myself as an accidental entrepreneur.
What do you mean by that?
Well, so, you know, when I was going to college and everything, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to get a, you know, in economics and marketing and communications, and I'm going to go live in New York City and live on Madison Avenue, and you know, I'm going to work for the largest ad agencies in the world, and that was what I had envisioned for my life. And then my dad got sick, and he got cancer, and so I ended up having to work full-time and then go to school at night, which was a very different path than I thought I was going to be on. And at that time, it wouldn't happen today, but when my dad's company found out he got cancer, they fired him. And so the money that was supposed to, was set aside for my college went to pay the mortgage, went to, you know, once he had this, or he had pancreatic cancer, and he was like the first to do this Whipple procedure and these radiation bullets, and they're like, my uncle was chief of staff of this hospital in Minneapolis, and he was an amazing surgeon. And he and a couple other surgeons, Dr. Benjamin and Dr. Young, literally saved my dad's life. But my dad's spirit is what saved him and his personal courage. And he lived for 7 years, which, I mean, that's unheard of. You know, we're not going to say exactly when, but it was a hot minute ago. And like, that is like, where does my magic come from?
Yeah.
That my parents.
How was that experience shape you as who you are?
It, you know, it's, it, I mean, in every way. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that I was super fortunate to have the best parents you could ask for.
Mm.
You know, I was raised with no limitations, that I could do anything, I could be anything, I could think anything, I could say anything within reason. I definitely colored outside those lines on more than one occasion. Usually, like, when my parents were having a cocktail party or something, I'd be like, so, hey, I'd like to interject in this conversation. And they would just be like, okay. Like, we're apologizing in advance for whatever Jennifer's about to say, right? But that gave me such a great foundation to ask questions, and they didn't treat me like a kid. I mean, occasionally, right? But like, I was allowed to engage in these adult conversations, which were so empowering. But circling back to the original question, where did my magic come from? My dad was diagnosed with cancer. It was, I went from being a teenager to an adult. And my mom, who is one of the strongest people I know, she kind of just froze. And then my sister was living in Hong Kong, teaching at the international school. And I became a parent. I became an adult. So working with the doctors and coordinating chemotherapy and what were the next steps, and you know, I was 18. And you know, it's my fun-loving, free-spirited self sort of I became more regimented, and I worked during the day and I went to school at night, and then in between figured out how to get my dad to and from appointments and doctors and helping to figure out with the insurance. And, you know, you grow up fast. So fast. I mean, literally it was, 45 days from figuring out if I was going to go on a date or not, or if we were going to go to the fall formal, to how am I going to do this? Yeah. And, I was fortunate that I left high school a little bit early to go to, we called it post-secondary then. I think now people call it dual enrollment. And so I was going to university, but I had to take one high school class. And so while I was going to university, I was working. And I think that gave me a grounding of magic doesn't happen because it's given to you. Magic happens because you
work at
create it.
It
and you work at it.
That's incredible.
And the luckiest people I know, the most magical people I know, are the ones that they don't give up. They've got grit and determination. And I mean, there are some really dark moments, where I fell away from my faith. I turned into a different version of myself physically.
How do you come back to the center?
Well, no one is going to love my dad for this comment, but he meant it in love. And I had put on just a lot of weight and I didn't feel good about myself. And I wasn't taking care of myself because I was so focused on taking care of him and taking care of my mom and going to work and then doing my papers. And, I would get up in the morning, I'd go to work and I'd study over lunch and then I'd go back to work and then I'd study in the break and then I'd go to school and then I'd come home and then I'd study till 2 o'clock in the morning. And then it was rinse and repeat.
For 4 years?
I'm 12 credit shorts of graduating. Yeah, I never finished.
What happened?
First I want to tell you the story about the finding myself again. Mm-hmm. My dad was in remission, which was unheard of. I mean, he was written up in medical journals, and so we all, my Aunt Kelly and my dad and my cousin Carrie, went to Norway. It was my dad's wish.
Oh my God.
And we were walking through Bergen, and I was in this outfit. You put an outfit on and you're like, I feel good. Yeah, I'm feeling this. And my dad, he was like, honey, I love you. And I was like, yeah, I do. And he's like, your rear end in those pants, it's like there's a fight going on. And I was like, ouch.
Yeah.
I don't love that. That was not great. But I had stopped looking at myself. I'd stopped looking at myself really in the mirror. I'd stopped taking care of myself. I was self-soothing by eating whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted. I'd stopped exercising. And part of my dad's therapy was to exercise and to walk. So I started walking around this lake in Eden Prairie, which is where I grew up. And it was called Starring Lake. And so I would walk with my dad. And slowly, I got stronger. My mind got clearer. At that time then, I was selling television advertising during the day and going to school at night. So it was a little closer to Madison Avenue, but still a long way away. And things became into focus again. And I started exercising. And I was like the fog sort of lifted. And then I was like, oh, okay. I kind of lost myself. But that was... that's where my magic comes from. That's where my courage comes from, is that experience. And even today, in my darkest moments where I think, I don't know how I'm going to get through this. It literally is sometimes it's one foot in front of the other.
What was the moment?
There have been many moments of where you just go, oh. But that moment, I thought, where do I want to go and what do I want to do? I'm not loving what I'm doing. Made a lot of money selling advertising, but it wasn't fulfilling to me. And a friend called me and said, hey, there's a marketing director opening at this restaurant and nightclub group. And I applied and I got the job. How I got the job, honestly, I have no idea. Thank you, Carol Ann Schindler, for taking a leap of faith on me. And And I got it, and I remember sitting in my office, and I was like, I got an office. What? And I was like 20. I mean, I wasn't even, you know, able to drink, but I was marketing restaurants and nightclubs across the United States. But that was one of the moments where I sort of went, okay, this is the next step in my journey. And with my dad and with college, I was like, I can't do this job and do this. So do I take the job that's paying me $65,000 a year back then?
That's like, amazing.
You know,
so much money.
$125,000 now, or do I finish? And so I decided that I can always go back. And then one thing led to another, and that opportunity led to me opening up a group of restaurants and nightclubs, 24 venues under one roof. It's crazy. Then that led to moving into a different role in consumer products as a VP of marketing and sales, and then that just sort of became the catalyst of my life. And one of the biggest changes, though, was when I started working for a CPG company in the Twin Cities that was importing seasonal items from China. And it was Christmas stuff, Christmas trees, lights, yeah, decorations, every holiday you could imagine. And I loved it. I loved the creative process. I loved the, you could see something. It was tangible. You could go into Target and you could be like, we did this. We built this modular, right? And then I was offered a job from the manufacturer in China. And
was that what you wanted at the time?
You have
so much success already in that restaurant and the nightclub marketing group.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I think the thing that if anyone says, like, what's the thing I take with me or what's my mantra in my life,
yeah,
is no fear.
Mm.
Because I think it's a useless emotion. Mm. It can paralyze you. Because then you get in the cycle of what if? What if I fail? What if this? What if, like,
so how do you deal with those irrational thoughts that we all have in our mind?
I mean, it's a constant sort of self-awareness and checking in. And, you know, like everybody else, I mean, there are times I'm really good at it, and there are times where I slip and I find myself with imposter syndrome. And
we all have that,
right? And I think it is the way that I have found my way through those, that darkness, I guess I would call it, is by being grateful.
Mm.
And by practicing gratitude.
Mm.
And
I love that.
You know, I mean, it's even when things are dark and they're painful and you're isolated, and, you know, being an entrepreneur, being an executive in different organizations can be lonely and it can be isolating.
Lonely on the top.
It is. It's incredibly lonely. And you have to make the hard decisions. Even when you know sometimes those decisions are going to impact people, they're going to impact people's ability to pay their mortgage or their rent, or they're going to lose their health insurance. Those are hard, but you have to do them if you want your company to be successful, whether it's a company that you're running, whether it's a company that you started. There's an obligation to do the right thing, and sometimes doing the right thing is really, really hard. Really hard. It would sometimes be easier to take the path that feels better, but oftentimes it's the path that is harder that is the path you're supposed to take.
That's beautiful. So tell us, how do you found China, or your experience in China, and how does that connect to entrepreneurship?
So accidental. It's such a good question. So I started as a vice president of global sales, and then about a year later, they promoted me to president of the entire organization. And I was really one of the first people to work in China. I was almost always the only woman at the table. And I loved China and I loved Hong Kong. And I have so many amazing experiences. And that really, my experience in China and in Hong Kong and different, you know, Thailand and Vietnam and India really shaped my existence. It took, you know, when you see, when you're in New York City or you see the horses and they have the blinders on, mm-hmm. and then the blinders come off. And, you know, I think so many people have a view of China that they see in the media or it's a governmental view. It's not the people. I have never met such so many people of one nationality that were kind and gracious and opened their doors. You know, I was in a couple of very dicey situations, and there were two people on the side of the road that came to my assistance where, you know, I really, truly think I was about to be abducted. And I was like, I'm like 5'1¾". So it's, but I was like, yeah, I'm not going down without a fight. And they could have looked the other way. And they didn't. And frankly, like, I could have come at a pretty high price tag at that time. And they protected me. They took me into their house and helped me, you know, find a car service to get me back to my hotel safely. And that can happen in any country, right? But, you know, they didn't turn away. Mm. They ran in. They didn't know me. They had no obligation.
Just a stranger helping
two strangers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Two women, actually. Mm. And I mean, but that's my experience. And it changed my perspective. It flipped the paradigm. I saw so many opportunities to grow as a leader, to expand my business footprint, to, you know, when I was there, we had a manufacturing facility and we had about 10,000 employees. And one of the things that was way out of my scope was retention, you know, employee retention. And that was a time where people would take buses and they'd go to rural villages and they would bring people into the major cities to work in these factories. And I thought we would be so much more effective if we could retain our employees. How do we do that? And so I would go down to the factory floor. We had a 4 million square foot manufacturing facility.
Wow, it's big.
Yeah, really big. We manufactured artificial Christmas trees and patio furniture. We were the largest manufacturer in Asia. And my big claim to fame there was we came up with the first pre-lit Christmas tree. And it completely disrupted the industry.
Wow.
And because of that, we became the first acquisition of Carlyle Group, which
impressive.
Is a whole nother story. But more important than that is that we empowered our workers. We taught them English. We had lessons so they could become more educated if they wanted to. If they wanted to learn more about mathematics or, you know, we offered courses and we put a pool in and basketball courts. And, you know, we just wanted it to be a place that they wanted to be. And then instead of just having quotas, we flipped it and we switched the focus to quality. So it wasn't, you know, we still had to get X amount done. But if we got X amount done and they were done correctly and we minimized the defective or return rate, everyone got a bonus. Mm. And so we had like a half of a half of a half a percent defective rate. And all the employees were able to participate in that success. Mm. And so we had like an 85% retention rate, which is
unheard of in manufacturing.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it wasn't just me. I mean, like, I may have been like the beginning of the idea.
You're a catalyst.
Yes, a catalyst. But that was... I mean, I think that's like one of the things I'm most proud of.
Yeah.
Actually.
And you speak about, like, in New York City, those horses with a blinder. I'm mm-hmm. curious, with, you know, years of experience you have in China, in businesses, meet all the incredible smart men and women and deal with so many situations. What is one biggest thing that surprised you positively or not, whatever that is? Like, what is that one big blinder that you hoped, you wish someone, other people can understand that a little bit more.
Within China specifically?
Yeah, or Asia.
I think that what people see on TV isn't reflective of the people who live there. Mm. They're just like us. You're taking a company that, or a country that's like facing sort of an industrial revolution of where East meets West, and they're learning that there's a whole other opportunity. They don't just have to work in a factory. There's this whole world of opportunities in front of them. And I think China is going to be a catalyst. I think there's going to be chaos there. And I think it's going to be really uncomfortable globally. But for the people of China, the people that I hold very close. Wow, a little teary. That we'll see them, you know, when those students walked around and they had papers and they were using physics to communicate the challenges that they were facing a year ago. Enormous courage. I mean, just so much. The protests in Hong Kong were by not just students, but everybody. And I think there's going to be a change. And I want people to understand that, that they are rising up and they are fighting for their independence. They're fighting for their voice. They don't want to be controlled. And I think us as Americans and global citizens have a responsibility to help lift them up and not just think that, you know, they're trying to steal all of our ideas. They're trying to, you know, that might be some bad people, and they might be some bad people in leadership, for sure. That happens. But that is a small percentage of an entire country. And I guess that's the blinders that I would wish people to look at from that experience.
Beautiful. So back to you. How's that connecting from that moment to the entrepreneurship later, Jennifer?
Well, so the in 2007, China created this law, and they called it sort of the workers were going to get severance. Really, it should have been maybe more communicated as profit sharing. But so for every year that a worker was there, they would get 1 month's severance. And because our company had been around for over 18 years, and we had a really, we had at that time a 72% retention rate going back. At the end, it was 85, but you know, the delta between that was maybe 3 years when we implemented the program. And the Carlyle Group essentially decided that it was going to be not affordable. So they put the company into receivership, even though we were super successful. We were
receivership.
Great, into receivership. We found out the day after Thanksgiving. And
they closed the company?
Well, they gave the executives 30 days to find an alternative.
Okay.
And on December 27th, we had found an investor that was going to put the money in. And then at the last minute, they pulled out on New Year's Eve.
What? Why?
They just decided that it was going to be too big of a risk. And we found out at the last minute that the Carlyle Group had leveraged the factory and the land as an asset. So what we would have been buying was the business, but eventually we'd have to relocate. Mm-hmm. And that was going to be cost prohibitive.
Mm-hmm.
So on...
was that shocking to you?
Yeah. And
how successful the business is, you the one that creates such a success and Hall of Fame, as you mentioned, and suddenly everything halt to a cease.
Yeah, it was devastating. And
how do you take that?
I started a company the next day.
The next day?
Yeah, I took the core members of my team, the core members from my factory and product development, and I negotiated a deal to go into the factory and buy all of our product development. And I submitted a bid to buy all of the brands that we had created. We didn't successfully bid that. We didn't get that, but we were able to get all the product development.
Okay.
And interesting story, actually. When we went into the factory with this big lorry, right, truck, right, this huge truck, and there was a representative trying to get the workers to unionize. And they tried to lock us in this office and physically restrain us. And
why? You?
Because they thought we were stealing from the workers.
Oh, but you say you purchased from them.
Yes, but, you know, imagine. They've just been told the factory's shutting down. And they see us going with this big truck, loading it up. They don't have any context of what's happening. And so they literally tried to, you know, take us hostage.
How would you communicate with them?
Well, I mean, we had some of our people with us, and there's a gentleman named Ben Gao who was one of the people that took me up on the offer to learn how to speak English. Mm. And he learned it so fast that we promoted him into product. Mm. And so he was, you know, maybe 30% fluent in English. So there was a lot of, and I can't speak it, but I understand, which is crazy.
Wow. Chinese?
I mean, yeah, don't test me now because it's been a long time. But it was sort of like my secret weapon in negotiations, especially when we'd have to negotiate with local and regional government officials. I'm like, yeah, that's not what you said. This is what you said, and this is what we agreed to. So we're not taking a 21% increase again because you said this is going to be good for this many years. So thanks, but no. Separate conversation. Anyway, so Ben, this union organizer was really coming at me, and everyone was sort of paralyzed. And I was like, bite me, you know, blank, blank. And I took this huge shelving unit, and I pushed him down, and I pushed the shelving unit on top of him, and I was like, don't do that. Like, you don't. No, we're not doing that. And so then, you know,
Were you not afraid that moment?
I wasn't afraid until we got back into Hong Kong. Mm. Because the adrenaline rush, I mean, I thought of my family, I thought of my kids, I thought of my employees that I just convinced to not take any income until we got sales.
And that's a day two of your company established.
Well, I mean, so we established it officially on the 1st, but everything was closed, so we couldn't, you know, get it done for a couple days later. But January 2nd, I was on an airplane to Hong Kong with my team.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's why I call myself an accidental entrepreneur, because it wasn't planned.
So almost a hypothetical, if the previous company did not have that accident, you might be a different path today.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Wow.
Definitely.
So yeah. Now starting your own company, mm-hmm. Going to heart. Coming heart, I'm curious, do you have any anticipation about what's going to happen in terms of entrepreneurship journey, or is everything go according to plan?
Oh.
What was something that surprised you the most?
How hard it was. I mean, it's easy to say, well, I'm going to just start a company. Like, that's just what we're going to do, right? Mm. But then you do it, and you're like, oh, okay. So I took for granted all of my account managers who had to fill out the retail documents, and we had to come up with the cube, and all of, we had to come up with names, and we had to come up with codes, and we had to get UPC codes, and you know, I was sort of living in the glass tower, and I could just delegate that. But now there's only 4 of us, and we have to do it.
Oh, wow.
And
that's so much.
Oh my God, it was so much. I mean, I can't even believe that we did it. I mean, it was unbelievable. But I will say that, you know, my team and the retailers that took a chance on us, Home Depot, Walmart, Canadian Tire, Menards, Orchard Supply, I mean, they had trust in us. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a factory. We had to find a factory to produce our product. And so, you know, we became QC, product development, sales, marketing, shipping.
Everything.
Anything. I mean, it was crazy. You know, and you'd have to bring your product and do this product line review. And so we'd have to set up our product, and mm-hmm. then you'd have to take it down. And I'm like, oh my God, on the streets of Shenzhen, you know, with like a cart pushing our product, you know. I mean, it was crazy. And but it's like what I said earlier, it's no fear. What's the worst that can happen? You fail.
And you're not afraid of failing?
No. I think what's worse than failing is not trying.
I love that.
That would be worse. It's like when I tell my team in any company that I've been in, the only decision is the decision you're not making. It's a bad decision.
Mm, that's so good.
Because you can come back from almost any bad decision. mostly, right?
Indecision, it is a decision.
Yeah.
That's beautiful said. Wow. So,
yeah, but we did it.
So tell us what happened after that.
So we did that for a couple of years, and we, you know, grew the business pretty rapidly. And then we were acquired by one of our competitors, a publicly traded company.
Congratulations.
Thank you, on the Hang Seng. And so I went to run that company. Hated it. Really.
What part?
I mean, really all of it.
Got it.
It was the CEO and chairman of that company, really brilliant guy, but had really sort of lost touch with how business is done now. How it was done 5 years ago, 10 years ago at that time was vastly different, and how it was changing and evolving and being vertically integrated was almost against you, because you couldn't bid anything out. You couldn't have cost savings. And I think at the time everyone was like, oh, we're vertically integrated and that's so lovely. But it ended up sort of biting us in the rear end. And we still were able to turn things around, and we had a really big uptick in sales. And but at the end of that contract, I thought, I'm probably not gonna do this again. And when I did that, you know, there was a lot of discussion about funds, and he was going through a difficult time, even though he was a very, 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 very wealthy man. You know, and I think actually I'm not going to share that story because...
Okay, no
problem. I'm like, oh, this is so juicy. I really want to share it, but probably not the wisest choice. Next time you can share it. But anyway, and that led to starting my second startup, which was an LED company, which I knew nothing about.
How does that happen? Why?
Interestingly enough, at this, the company that acquired my company, the first one I started, right? They were doing LED lights, and they were doing it from the origin. So they were literally growing the sapphires, which is where LED chips come from. And I thought, this is amazing. And before when we were getting our what I call our sea legs, we were doing a lot of consulting for factories in China and who wanted to get into business in the U.S. And it was how we sustained ourselves while we were waiting for the purchase orders to be funded. Mm-hmm. And we did some consulting for an LED company. And I thought, this is where the market's going to go.
Nice.
And so when we had this opportunity and we were approached by someone that I used to work with, said, hey, we should start an LED company. And so we did. And which I
no fear again.
I mean, no, honestly, I mean, like, it, no, not really. It was more of such an opportunity. And, you know, we did a competitive matrix and SWOT analysis.
You did the whole thing.
The whole thing, yeah, right? Like, yeah. Where are we going to fit in this space? Where can we get better? And so I went around to China and went to the factories, and I poached what I thought were the best engineers, and we hired them. And because an LED at that time was like a boat anchor. It was so heavy that if you literally wanted to retrofit it into your existing fixtures, it would pull the fixtures down.
Oh, wow.
And so we thought, how can we do this differently? And then one of the engineers said, well, why don't we look at aircraft aluminum? Because it's a great conduit for heat and it's lightweight. Mm-hmm. So we did. And, you know, we messed around with that for a while. And then we launched it, and we went sort of the traditional way, which was getting distributors and being on a line card. And we weren't scaling fast enough. And I was like, we're going to run out of money. You know, like this is going to end badly. Ouch. And so I thought, okay, like, what would my 19-year-old self do? And I had read this book, which if anybody hasn't read it, it's a must read. It's Guerrilla Marketing. And so I thought, okay, we're going up against GE, Philips, Osram, Sylvania, you know, I mean, Fight, all of these different brands. And I thought, all right, I'm going to go to Landmarks. So we went to like the New York Public Library and Navy Pier, Mall of America, some of the memorials in Washington, and we got people's attention, and people were losing bids to this little teeny tiny company called Lumina. And they're like, who the F are you? And where did you come from? Now, we didn't make a lot of money on those, But that set the platform for us to be acquired. And then we sold that company to a publicly traded company here in the U.S.
Congrats.
Yeah. We didn't make a lot of money on that transaction, but thank you. But it was a really great experience of being an entrepreneur, thinking that you have enough money and enough runway, only to find out even when you're doing it smart and lean, it still wasn't enough. You know, I think retrospectively, we should have done more due diligence in the sales cycle process. And, you know, what percentage of the business was RFP? What percentage of it was direct? What percentage of it was retail? And you know, again, not knowing that industry, that was definitely a bit of a strike against us. But we brought in, you know, a subject matter expert who had a lot of experience in this space. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like you win some, you lose some. We ultimately ended up winning, but I think that's, you know, for any entrepreneurs out there, I would say when you look at the money that you're trying to raise, double it.
Mm.
Because the amount of runway that you're going to need, the amount of pivots that you're going to have to take, the evolution of what your vision starts at and where it ends up is not always the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's critical to being successful is pivoting.
So speaking of pivoting, I think you are the queen of pivot. Coming from with a dream of Madison Avenue to one business after another, and now second time successful as is a business. What's next for you, Jennifer?
Well, I took a role in a healthcare company. That's what got me to Austin.
Which is how in the world coming from LED to healthcare tech?
Well, this is actually I think it's a fun story. You may be like, yawn. But, you know, like college kids, a lot of times they take a gap year.
Uh-huh.
And when we sold the company to this other company that acquired us, I had a contract. And at the end of that, again, I just thought sometimes it's hard when you are being integrated into another company. Mm-hmm. And really, this was just you had to sort of fight to have a seat at the table. And trust me, I'm down for a good fight.
Like, you are the born fighter.
But it's when you spend more time trying to posture and do internal politics, like I tune out.
Mm.
I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in growing a business. I'm interested in scaling a business. I'm interested in being successful. I don't care what your title is. I please, that's just yawn, you know, move on. And so I did, and I took a gap year, and I became an intern. I went to become an intern for a friend of mine who was a CTO at a defense contractor, and I can't say who.
Yeah,
and
of course.
But I learned about nanotechnology and AI and machine learning and
geofencing. What inspired that decision? That is such a courageous move.
You know,
you sold the business, now you become an intern, turn around.
Well, I mean, I had a non-compete that was tighter than Fort Knox. So I couldn't go back into the industry that I had spent so much time in it. And note to self, anybody who's negotiating a non-compete, make sure you have a really good lawyer first look at it, because there was one line in there that didn't just keep me out of the lighting business. It kept me out of the consumer products business.
Oh, that's why you had to turn 360 from all the manufacturing product to now. Yeah. Let's look at the tech.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there were I could have gone to sell Barbies. There was a little wiggle room. But I thought, what a gift.
I was going to say, it sounds like you have a completely different trajectory because of that.
Yeah. And I loved it. I wasn't responsible for anything. I had to, you know, meet some deadlines. I did research, but because I had been a CEO, because I had worked in so many different levels, and, you know, when I was running the company in China, I zigzagged through the factory. So I understood how operations worked. I understood how shipping worked. I understood the supply chain. I understood the marketing. I the sales. And it was and the finance. And so it gave me an opportunity, and that's where the market was really going, right? Like, retailers didn't care so much about the brand because they were creating their own brands and white labeling things. So being a brand didn't have the same cachet that it did. And even now, if you go to the grocery store, what percentage of the product that you're seeing is white labeled versus what percentage of it is branded? It's almost like 30% white label.
Mm.
And I think that's going to continue to happen because brands have more expenses. They have advertising. They have to pay for shelf space. It's a different model, and mm-hmm. it's getting harder and harder. But with technology, I thought, oh, this is really juicy. And I have nothing to lose and everything to gain by just jumping into the deep end. And I found out that I loved it. I found out I was a terrible coder. but I could understand it enough to be dangerous. I understood how people were building out stacks. I understood how it can be used for good and how it can be used for bad. And you know, about antennas and nanotechnology and how you can build something really powerful in this little teeny tiny package. And
just like you.
Thank you.
Small but mighty.
Small but mighty. That's funny. When I was in fourth grade, Mr. McGrail's class, who I loved him. Teachers are like my unsung heroes.
Oh.
And in Mr. McGrail's fourth grade class, I was like literally the littlest one in the class. And we had to get something off the top shelf, and he had left the classroom to do something. And I was like, shorty to the rescue or whatever. And I was like, you know, my daughter calls me like a spider monkey. So I was like a spider monkey, and I like climbed up to the top of this thing, and I took it out. And he came back, and he's like, he goes, who? And I was like, I didn't. He's like, how did you get that? I'm like, well, I just climbed up. And he was like, thanks for getting that, but maybe next time I just grab the ladder or something. You know, you could have gotten hurt. And I was like, but I didn't. And I mean, that's sort of a mantra, like, I didn't get hurt. I could have, but I didn't. And there are times that, you know, you do get hurt in this process, right? Not in school, anybody, just, you know.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, that's like, yeah.
That's incredible. I felt like you always have this, the courage to choose to see the bright side in whatever thing you do.
You know, when my dad, I mentioned him earlier, when he was dying, you know, I talked to him every day.
Oh.
And I mean, he was just my best friend and my biggest cheerleader. And when I flew out a couple weeks before he passed away, and, you know, he had become very emaciated, right?
Mm.
But we were cuddling, and I was like, Daddy, how do you keep going? How do you fight every day? You know? And he's like, well, I make a choice. Every day I wake up, I see the sunrise, I feel grateful. And every night I see the sunset, I lived another day. I got to live with the love of my life. And
so beautiful.
And so, like, I guess that's where it's at for me, is that I can make a choice. And even when things are really shitty. And I mean, I have been through some many, many, many terrible, shitty experiences. You know, I made a lot of money, I've lost a lot of money and everything in between. But the thing is that you get a choice. We all get a choice.
Mm.
We can either choose to see the glasses half full. Doesn't mean we need to be taken advantage of. Doesn't mean we're not observant and blind. But it means that you can feel grateful for the things that you have, not the things that you don't have. And, you know, I think we live on a ranch, and you know, that keeps me really grounded.
Mm.
You know, the fixing fences and feeding the chickens and, you know, grooming the horses and cleaning the stalls and all the minutiae that goes with that is my centering space. You know, it's like my moment where I can turn my brain off and it can problem solve, and it brings me joy. And I think everyone in their life, even when you're sad and even when times are hard, there's one thing that can bring you joy. Maybe it's just the sunrise. Maybe it's the breeze. Maybe it's how the grass feels underneath your feet. Maybe it's a cool sip of water. You know, maybe someone smiles at you and you didn't feel seen. I mean, I certainly have not felt seen in my life.
Why do you say that? You have been so successful, and I imagine you're the center of attention wherever you go, not in a bad way, but you are the one that bring the catalyst in every scenario. So why you say that?
Well, I mean, I think it's easy to look at me and think that. And I certainly sometimes look at people and I think that. But certainly I felt invisible. I felt invisible with friends at times. I felt invisible with colleagues, with children. Your children can make you feel invisible. They are the great equalizer of things when you think, I got this. Yeah. Did you just see this thing that I just did? And your kids are like, yeah, so. As they get older, I think, that will change. But I think sometimes feeling invisible is normal. And I think if you always need to be the center of attention, and you always want the light shined on you, or you take all the oxygen in the room, you're doing a disservice to yourself and to other people. I mean, there's two separate points there. One is the feeling invisible, and I think that's just part of life. Everyone sometimes feels bad, and I have to remind myself, take a minute, go do something that brings joy to me, whatever that is. And the not sucking all the oxygen out of the room when you're a leader. I am actually very shy.
I don't get that from you, Jennifer.
I am. When I have so much, I don't want to say anxiety because I think people overuse anxiety. I mean, I think it's sort of become this like calling card of, I have anxiety. Okay, everybody has a little bit of anxiety.
We all have that, yeah.
But I think, we have a mutual friend, Linda. And Linda's like, you have to come. I'm like, I don't know these people. I don't want. And she's like, you are coming. And so then I'm like, okay, I only have to talk to five people. If I talk to five people, it's a win for me. And people don't understand that about me. It's different. Like if I'm presenting my company or if I'm presenting my team or I'm talking about my product, I'm not shy. But if I have to go up to someone that I haven't met, I got to dig a little deeper. And so I think that's like something I've struggled with most of my life, actually.
Wow.
Yeah. And when I'm with people that I know, I'm with my village, yeah, I'm super fun. I will be the catalyst. I'll be the like, hey, there's an empty table over there. No one's dancing. And we'll just see what happens, but that's different than being dropped in a room of people where you have to network and you have to tell your story. I'm great at telling other people's story, but telling my story has always been a challenge.
Why is that?
I don't know. It's a really good question. Mm. I mean, that's literally something that I'm trying to unpack.
You do it so beautifully today.
Well, yeah, it's you and I in a closed room and no one's staring at us.
No one is staring at us. Right? Just you and me.
And, and I know you.
Yeah,
right?
Good.
So, and I have, admiration and respect for you. So it's easy to feel safe.
Mm.
And
do you feel seen today, Jennifer?
I do. So thank you.
I'm curious because one thing that is very strike me, what inspired me so much about you is on one hand, you are this super ultra success, global CEO and just done everything under the sun and can go to every table, have a seat on the table and crushing any conversation. And on the other end, you are extremely grounded, connect to the joy, connect to what really bring your light. And I just felt you have such an incredible balance about you. And I cannot imagine you say you are not, you find it difficult to talk because every time I see you, you're always this, almost like I imagine like a light in the room. You're always this light that gravitate people to you.
That is so nice.
And I imagine you really, maybe because what your own experience, so you go out of your way to make sure everyone feel inclusive, everyone feel connected, everyone feel seen. And I think that's one of your magic gift.
Thank you. That is, I hope so. I mean, I want people to feel seen and heard and listened to,
That's how I felt when I first met you.
Ah, really? That's
yeah.
So nice.
That's what made an impression of you. And I thought, I need to talk to Jennifer.
Oh, that's really nice. Thank you.
I think it takes tremendous courage. to turn our pain into a gift, to bring people forward, bring that unity and connection forward.
Well, life is short.
I love that.
You know, and I think, you know, losing my dad at such a young age, you know, it's, I was dealing with things that other people couldn't
fathom.
They couldn't fathom.
Yeah,
you know,
19.
And my parents were unifiers. And they, you know, one of my most favorite things of my childhood memory of, and what I pay it forward as an adult, is that both sets of grandparents, when I was little, would always set an extra place at the dinner table.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, why are you doing that? And both, you know, different parts of Minnesota, which is where I'm from, and but the same answer. And they both said that, well, that's for the friends we haven't met yet.
Oh, that was the sweetest thing I ever heard.
Yeah, and my parents carried that on, and I carried on, because we become, I think, so closed to people and allowing people in our lives, you know, on a personal level. And,
yeah,
you know, I think that I've had friends who have had so much and lost so much, and I personally have had so much and lost so much and got it back, right? But it's humbling.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've had to ask for help, and knowing that, you know, in the old days, people would put a candle in their window.
Okay.
And we do that. And that's for the people walking by, knowing that your home is a safe home and they can come knock on the door.
Oh.
And I think that's how I want my life to be. That's how I want my businesses to be. It's companies that they can always knock on the door and they're going to be heard. And I think that's
beautiful.
That's so important.
That's so beautiful. So what do you want to leave on this planet? One day when we're all long gone, when people think about Jennifer, what do you want people to remember you by?
I think that I was kind. You know?
You are.
I think that's like, if that's it, that's perfect. And that I leave behind a family and children that are good people.
I know your daughter and your son are extremely proud of you. Are you proud of yourself, Jennifer?
I am. Yeah. I am. I had good role models.
You know, today, you just seem like such a warrior. Maybe that's just how, you know, maybe outside world perceive you. I'm curious, do you see that about yourself? And what do you think is your superpower?
I mean, yes, I am for sure a warrior.
Mm.
And the one thing about being a warrior is that you have to know when to put your shield down.
Mm.
And when it's not a fight.
Mm. Is it hard?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I became a warrior at 18. You know, I fought for my dad. I fought for our family. I fought for his life, you know. And it's hard when you are so young and, you know, having to fight health insurance and, you know, I drove down to the company that fired him and I was like, I just want you to know what you did and I'm never going to forget. And you know what? Like, you don't have to answer to me, but you're going to have to answer to God for that one. So you should think about it. I mean, I was 18. I mean, how ballsy to do that. I came back and told my dad and he was like, I thought he was going to be mad at me. And he goes, thank you. And
he's so proud of you.
I can feel him. Yeah. And my mom. They're both passed now.
Oh.
But the what do I hope for the future?
Mm-hmm.
I think to just do more of the same. Mm-hmm. To create change and build companies and expand companies and create opportunities and you know, bring in people for different opportunities. You know, one thing I wanted to share with you that it was a really hard lesson for me and was pretty recent. I had brought this person in who at the time was homeless and living out of his car, but really brilliant. And I didn't have money to give him a full-time job, but I'm like, this could be an internship and this is what I could pay you. And he agreed to it. And then about six months later, a process server came to the ranch and he was suing me. Yeah, really shocking. So shocking. And even with, you know, an NDA and an agreement in place. And when I read what he wrote, I was like, that's bullshit.
So people take advantage of your kindness.
They can. But what could have made me really hard and really angry was when I really took a step back and I looked at all of the contributions that he made. Why I think he did it was because he didn't feel seen. So for me, wanting to make people feel seen, when I went back and I was going through all of the emails and all of the content, I think there was a lot of things that got missed because I was so busy and there were so many moving parts. And I gave him hope and then I kind of took a little bit away. And so I think, you know, he did that in anger and we eventually figured out what was fair for both of us. But the lesson to me there was you can do good and bad things can happen from it. Also, what's the part that you have to own? And sometimes, you know, just it's not, you don't have anything to own. Sometimes it's just a person's just being a jerk and trying to take advantage of you. And sometimes that happens. In this particular case, you know, there was a thread of truth in that. And it made me uncomfortable when I had to peel it back and look at it and be like, yeah, I mean, he didn't deserve this big ask, but he deserved this piece.
I think it's incredible. Not only you have such a courage to face in the outside world, but at times when it call, you also have a courage to looking inwards. And I think that ritual respect, that ability to look inward to see what is fair, what is not, and see how can we learn from that. That is one of your superpower. So you can continue to grow.
Yeah.
And pivot.
That would be my catalyst. My superpower, right, is to constantly change and evolve and own the good things about yourself and look at the things that maybe make you feel uncomfortable and why do they make you feel uncomfortable. And because the only way that we can nurture and mentor people to take our place is by doing that. You know, like my daughter hates when I say this, but like I oftentimes think of myself as the smartest dumb person in the room because I like to surround myself with people who I think are smarter than I am and who want my job. That's how I constantly am learning about new things. And I love it. It's energizing. It's
beautiful.
It's humbling at times, let me tell you. But yeah.
I love that you have no problem to put yourself in a, maybe humbling a little bit, but that just means you really are grounded in where you are, having that growth mindset to continue to learn and evolve and continue to be that catalyst, that fireball in the room.
Thank you.
What is one wisdom you wish to part way with your daughter or son or any other, you know, people who are listening in along your, you know, decades of experience in businesses? Like you said, you win some, you lose some, everything in between. What is one piece of wisdom you wish everyone can take from your experience?
I think it's what I started with. No fear.
I
mean, when you look at it, I'm always like, what's my worst case scenario? And if I can live with my worst case scenario, then go for it.
You accept
if the you worst. Can't, if you can't live with that worst case scenario, then you shouldn't do it, right? Then you should move on. But if you can, then do it. Try it. If you fall down, I mean, it's going to hurt. I mean, I'm not going to lie. It's going to really hurt. It's going to be really unpleasant. But again, I would just, my advice is to try. And it doesn't matter, like, to be an entrepreneur, you could be a journalist, you could be an artist, you could be a social media expert, you could do what you're doing. You didn't know that at this time you were going to interview over like 150 people. Like, that's amazing. Hello. So I feel like it's been a little bit about the Jennifer show, which just makes me slightly uncomfortable.
You're doing so good.
But I just think that like just take the risk.
Yeah.
And do the thing that makes you feel good. If you're doing something and it makes you feel bad, then move on.
You know, I love so much about you, Jennifer, is you don't always have the answer, but you just keep going, move forward. And even you say you're not comfortable, you're always just moving forward. That tenacity, that courage, you keep shining your light no matter what, that commitment to your truth, higher self, and having that continued growth mindset to pivot, to figure things out and make things happen. I truly think that is what made you a true warrior, that with such a humanity and kindness in heart, but continue to do good things on this planet. I think it's so beautiful. So again, thank you so much
for
coming.
Thank you for having
me. This
appreciate
show
it.
And share such a heartfelt story about you. And I'm just so grateful.
Thank you. I appreciate it so much.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in today. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I do. I cannot wait to see you all next week. Goodbye.
Bye.